Tonight on the Daily Debrief, rapper A$AP Rocky is out of jail as he awaits a verdict. We discuss why. And R&B singer R. Kelly pleads not guilty to new sex crimes charges. Plus, sentencing for a Georgia couple in the abuse killing of their foster daughter. But not everyone likes the verdict.
I know that they got this wrong this time.
Also, abuse and insanity in the trial of a Florida student who admits killing her mother and stepfather. The jury has this case. The Daily Debrief recaps the day in court. It's Friday, August 2nd.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to The Debrief. We've got a couple of famous cases off the top tonight. Rap artist A$AP Rocky has been released from a Swedish jail pending a verdict in his assault trial. The American artist, seen here in photos obtained by Swedish police, is accused of assault. He says he acted only in self-defense because he believed he was going to be attacked. But prosecutors seized text messages from Rocky's entourage, which accuse Swedish authorities of racism and suggest deleting evidence. During the case, prosecutors also said videos posted online by A$AP Rocky were edited to make the rapper look innocent. But a witness who testified in this third day of the trial suddenly changed her story from original police reports. Prosecutors have asked for a six-month sentence if A$AP Rocky is convicted. The defense has asked for community service. Joining us tonight are Judge Ashley Wilcott and attorneys Brad Micklin and Michael Bryant. So, Judge Wilcott, I'll start with you. Why would a judge let someone go just on the cusp of a verdict? Any insight on that?
Okay, so first of all, it's unusual, especially here in the United States. I'm not sure about Sweden. But having said that, I think a couple of things. Number one, that judge is either going to rule not guilty, and so it doesn't matter to the judge where he is. Number two, the sentencing is very light. They're asking all the way from community service by the defense to 6 months by the prosecution. So perhaps the 1 month that he spent in jail is going to be sufficient to the judge if he does find him guilty.
Brad Micklin, international implications in this case. President Trump tweeting that A$AP Rocky is actually on his way home here to the United States, regardless of what happens in Sweden. We're not sure exactly if he's on a plane or where that stands, but that's what the president says. What's your perspective on the political pressure here? Did that influence things?
I don't think so. I mean, there might have been some goodwill that Sweden judge was trying to develop. But I think, like the judge said, I think it's more of a message that we're not likely to find him guilty, because they could have released him from prison but kept him in Sweden, but they let him leave the country. And if they thought there was even a chance they'd have to bring him back and a possible international incident, I don't think they would have released him like that.
Michael Bryant, Swedish authorities have said, wait a minute, we have an independent judiciary here. To heck with the international rumblings from the president to the United States. Forget the political leaders in Sweden. The judiciary is independent there as it is here. So did that crumble, or what's going on?
Yeah, I'm not sure if having Trump tweet something in your favor is a good thing, and I'm not sure another government would give it much credence. I think the key to this case is the severity or lack of severity of the crimes involved. I mean, assault, not a good thing, not going to condone it. But if it were a murder case, maybe we'd see a totally different situation here.
It is possible. We're going to move on now. R&B singer R. Kelly has pleaded not guilty to new federal sex crimes charges in New York. Kelly is accused of racketeering. That's a crime involving coercion and sex trafficking. Prosecutors say Kelly forced women and girls to call him daddy and ask for permission to eat or use the bathroom. The defense says Kelly is being victimized by what they call groupie remorse. The judge is ordering Kelly to remain in jail without bail so that he cannot tamper with witnesses. Let's break down the verdict tonight and the sentence we brought you live last night here on The Debrief against the Georgia husband and wife who now stand convicted of abusing their two-year-old foster child and killing her. The 49-count indictment was hard to process all at once here last night, so hopefully this clears up the key points. The jury convicted husband Joseph Rosenbaum of second-degree murder, first-degree cruelty to a child, second-degree cruelty to a child, and aggravated assault. Those are just some of the charges and verdicts. The jury acquitted wife Jennifer Rosenbaum of malice murder and one count of felony murder, but convicted her on another count of felony murder, first-degree cruelty to a child, aggravated battery, and aggravated assault. Again, those are just some of the charges and the verdicts. All said and done, Joseph Rosenbaum was sentenced to 50 years with 30 of those 50 years to be served in prison. Jennifer Rosenbaum was sentenced to life in prison plus 40 years. During a sentencing hearing, which immediately followed the verdict, the victim's biological mother said she was still partially blaming herself.
They were given the opportunity to have a really precious baby in their life. And instead, they took her life. And I've blamed myself over the last 4 years a lot for what's happened to my baby. Because of my actions, that caused her to be in their home. But I just want to say that now I see that I don't have to blame myself anymore because I never hurt my babies. I love them very much. And I just hope that the time that they do in there, I hope that they really have time to feel something.
Several others and, of course, the prosecutor spoke out for the victim. But many of the defendant's friends lashed out at the verdict.
Please be lenient. I know this all could have been prevented if the biological mother and the family, it starts when that child is born, it starts with them. That's the first step of responsibility. This all could have been prevented if they would have took that responsibility and not diminished yourself with drugs and alcohol.
I respect our justice system and I respect this process, but I fear this time they got it wrong. The things said in this courtroom and the accusations that were made are completely inconsistent with the person that I know. The ripple effect of this accident is so far-reaching, as evidenced by all of the people here today. But I do believe that's what it was, a tragic accident.
I believe it in the justice system, but they did get it wrong this time. And they didn't prove anything when they stood up there and did their whole thing and whatever else they did. I know that they got this wrong this time.
They were good parents, both of them. They would never do this. It was an accident. I don't care what anybody says. My son is going to die in prison because they're not going to take care of him. So I've lost my son. So please be lenient.
The judge cut into those family members who he thought disrespected the verdict.
It is deeply frustrating for the court to hear family members of the defendants quarrel with the verdict. This case was carefully tried, and I'm deeply concerned of the lack of recognition on behalf of the defendant's family, of the scope of the tragedy, and of the cause of the tragedy. I've lived with this case for a long time, too. And I will tell you that it is one of the worst crimes and outcomes that anyone could ever experience or dream of experiencing. I just want to say that I feel for and deeply pained by your loss.
Let's head back to the panel for this one. Judge Ashley Wilcott, you sat on the bench yourself. Do you agree that there's something to be said here about respect for verdicts, and how do you think the judge handled it?
Well, you know, I'm surprised. I'm not surprised. Yes, I agree there needs to be respect for the verdicts, but it's also during sentencing a time for those who want to speak on behalf of either the defendant or the victim to really have the floor, so to speak, and say what they think and why they think it. And so while I get that the judge regretted that he didn't hear respect for the verdict, that's not unusual to hear that from those who have the floor during sentencing.
I thought the judge set a really good tone at the end there and tried to wrap things up with respect to all of those involved. Brad Micklin here, several people speaking in favor of the defendants, said, though, that they weren't really prepared to speak, but that they were speaking anyway. Is that anyone's fault? And if so, whose fault?
Well, it had to be the defense attorney's fault if we're going to blame anybody, because they should have known at some point in time they were going to be called to speak. But regardless of their opinions, you can't blame anybody but Jennifer and Joseph for this crime. It doesn't matter what the natural parent may or may not have done, or Child Protective Service may or may not have done. There's two people, they were convicted, and there's nothing else that you could say to justify anybody else's blame.
Michael Bryant, your final thoughts on this, when you've been covering it a long time along with me.
You know, the practical considerations are I understand that with Joseph's dad, you know, yes, if this natural parent had taken care of the child, this never would have happened. That's just one way for him to try and rationalize in his brain what he's just seen happen to his son. It's brutal, and maybe on appeal, there'll be some relief from that. Who knows?
Judge Ashley Wilcott, of course, this case is going to move in that direction, I assume, an appeal. A lot of people are wondering, is one of the appeals issues going to be that the defendants were represented by the same attorney? What are your thoughts on that?
I think that's an obvious appeal in a lot of cases when there's any alleged conflict. So I would absolutely expect that that is one that would be raised.
And Brad Micklin, I'll ask this question for you. Let's take the defense side of this. There was evidence presented by the defense that perhaps what happened here was a seizure, that perhaps the defendants thought that it was choking on a piece of chicken because that's what they thought was happening. And did they injure this poor girl trying to render relatively harsh life-saving treatments? Is that all possible? And is that going to be the appeal, just an appeal on the core facts?
Well, it may be. I mean, look, from a defense standpoint, it is a good defense. You know, often when there's a death of a child, there isn't much of a defense. And this makes a lot of sense, to especially to a parent that wants to find how could somebody do something like this. But when you couple it with all the injuries that the child had and all the history, that's what negates it and makes it a felony murder issue.
It's hard to appeal on the facts. That's right. What the jury's there to decide. Well, still ahead tonight here on The Debrief, the case of a Florida student who admitted to killing her mother and stepfather. The jury has that case where family abuse and mental illness are in the mix for the defense. We will be right back with that. This just into Law and Crime, a Florida judge is allowing a jury to deliberate as late as it wants in the case of a student accused of shooting and killing her mother and stepfather. Nicole Nachman admits pulling the trigger, but she's raising an insanity defense involving schizophrenia. She's also raising battered child syndrome as self-defense, saying she was abused and finally snapped back. The last defense witness in this case was a psychologist who talked about the defendant's complaints of screaming in her head and delusions, which made the defendant think motivational posters were encouraging her to kill. Here were the defense experts' conclusions.
She was suffering from a severe mental illness at the time. She was suffering from schizophrenia, which it's no exaggeration, I think, to say that schizophrenia is the cancer of mental illness. It's the most severe mental illness. We discussed what led up to it, and it's clear to me that she was delusional and that she believed that her mother would kill her when she revealed all of these lies and half-truths and evasions that she had used with her mother, things lying about her bicycle not being stolen, lying about renting a shed to store her belongings, lying about the dormitory, that she had gotten a room, that she didn't forget to get the room. There were a whole bunch of really small things that piled up for her.
That same expert went on to read from his report what the defendant told him.
He had worked up what she thought was the nerve to kill herself. And when I asked her why she killed Bob, her stepfather, she said, "I don't know what my thought process was. An overwhelming fear, it was like a flash forward. It felt like the confrontation with my mother was taking place. It was like that fast forwarded through my head like a movie. I thought, I'm going to die. Mom's going to kill me, and they're going to cover it up. I can't explain killing Bob. Fear does not have a rationality. Even though nothing was happening, I felt like I was suffocating. It was very hard to live. I had dug my own grave with lies. It was more like a panic. I shot Bob in the head. I was planning to shoot myself. He was there. I shot him in the back of the head, one shot. I panicked, and I thought someone would hear and call the cops and come and arrest me."
On cross-examination, the same psychologist sparred with the prosecutor over what the defendant thought she was doing when she pulled the trigger.
She didn't understand that she was killing someone. or injuring someone.
All right, well, that leads us to the consequence. Because yes. The doing is the shooting. So you now just said you do agree she knew what she was doing. She knew she was shooting the gun.
Yes, but she didn't. She wasn't aware of what the consequences of that would be.
That she did not know that she was going to kill or potentially seriously injure Robert Deans?
That's exactly what I'm saying, yes.
What did you think she was doing?
She was in, I don't know what she was doing. She was in a psychotic state. She couldn't, her reality testing was extremely poor. She had no present capacity to think.
The vehicle, based on GPS coordinates when her mom got home, was parked approximately 1.7 miles away. She stays at the home when this mother, who she's so deathly afraid of, is coming home, correct?
She stayed, yes.
And she parked her car away so that her mom would not see it and her mom would not know she was home, correct?
Well, I don't know who parked the car. I assume she parked the car.
She runs into her mother, correct?
Yes.
She still has the gun in her hand, correct?
Yes.
And we've already established that she knows how to shoot the gun. She knows what shooting a gun is. So she knows, again, when we go into Miriam Deans,
mm-hmm.
she yes. knows what she was doing, shooting a gun, and she eventually shot her mother, correct?
Again, I don't believe she knew what she was doing. She was in a psychotic state.
During a rebuttal, the state called another psychiatrist to refute defense claims of mental illness.
She doesn't meet the criteria for schizophrenia.
Right. What does she not mean?
She doesn't have any of the symptoms. The hallucinations, she doesn't have any hallucinations. I asked her directly about symptoms consistent with schizophrenia. She denied that. I asked her about the screaming that I read in other reports. She denied that it was screaming. She said that it was a high-pitched tone that she heard, like a flat line. She never described any hallucinations. She never described any voices. She never described visual hallucinations. She never described delusions. I asked her specifically about those items. She did not endorse any of those, which was consistent also with the jail medical records that said she did not have any psychotic symptoms. Nicole was not reporting psychotic symptoms to me, and I asked her extensively about it because I knew it was a cause for clinical concern. She did talk about saying that she felt that her mom was going to kill her. It's the whole basis for this crime.
Right. Did you feel that was a delusion?
No.
Explain why not.
I felt that it was her rationale to be able to get out of the consequences of her actions. So I thought that that was the basis of malingering.
During closing arguments, the state argued that the defendant was legally sane and therefore can be convicted.
These are not disorganized, illogical thoughts. These are not hallucinations. She knows exactly what she's done and what's happening. There are no suicidal thoughts in her mind when she talks to Joey. And what's one of the last things she says? If only I would have gotten the news earlier, I wouldn't have had to do it. If only she would have gotten the news about her housing earlier, she wouldn't have had to set the trap that she set for her mother to walk right into so that she could kill her and eliminate her from her life and eliminate the way that she hampered Nicole from living the life the way she wanted to live it. And she killed Robert first for no reason but that he stood in her way of executing her plan. Ladies and gentlemen, we are not unsympathetic to mental illness. And it is not disputed that Nicole Nachtman has a mental illness. But her mental illness did not justify the execution-style murders of Robert and Miriam Deans between August the 18th and August the 20th of 2015. And based on that, we are asking that you find her guilty of first-degree premeditated murder.
The defense argued that Nicole Nachtman was both psychotic and delusional when she pulled the trigger and was therefore unaware of the consequences.
Does that make sense? Happy, loved, developed teenagers, college students, wake up one morning and say, you know what, I'm going to execute my plan as the state wants you to believe and shoot my mother and my stepfather for no reason whatsoever. What caused this happy, fun-loving child that everybody testified to in this trial, even the state's witnesses, to go from this? She's contemplating killing herself. She's contemplating what she's going to do about housing. She is psychotic and delusional. The only verdict supported by the facts, the law, and the evidence is one of not guilty by reason of insanity as to both counts. Because when Nicole Nachman shot Robert Deans and Miriam Deans, she was psychotic, she was delusional, she was schizophrenic, and she did not know what she was doing or its consequences.
Returning now, Judge Ashley Wilcott, along with attorneys Brad Micklin and Michael Bryant. So, Brad, what do you make of these closing arguments? Did she know what she was doing when she pulled the trigger, or did she not? How does the jury get inside her head and try to rationalize what she thought from what she might not have thought?
I don't think a jury can. I mean, the only part of the case that even made any sense or was compelling was the beginning part when she said, you know, normal, happy people don't just drive home and kill their parents, which makes sense. But then it became, well, she didn't know what she was doing, or she did because she was abused. You can't have both. And I think that's a major defect in the defense. And I think the jury's going to be at best confused and at worst not believing it.
Judge Ashley Wilcott, the law on this matter in Georgia, you know, it's tough wrapping your head around some of these mental illness laws as it comes to criminal culpability. What's the best way to explain what the jury has to try to figure out here?
Here's what they have to figure out. They've heard lots of testimony, and they just argued in the defense closing, hey, she was in a psychotic state. Well, from my perspective as a judge, as the law, it doesn't matter if she's in a psychotic state. What they have to understand is, was she insane at the time she pulled the trigger, meaning that she did not know or could comprehend that what she did was wrong? That's the issue. That's how you can easily define it.
Okay, Michael Bryant, so ultimately the jury deliberating potentially into the evening, potentially even tomorrow, the judge raised that scepter without directly telling the jurors. It might go on this evening, they might wrap it up this evening, we don't know, but this is a hard deliberation whenever we see these mental health defenses.
No doubt about it. I'm sure they're wrestling with it, and if they think they're getting close, they'll go late tonight. If they think they're really close, maybe they'll come back tomorrow to wrap things up. But it is a difficult issue for these jurors to deal with.
It's hard to get inside somebody else's head. I mean, it's easier when it's a factual discrepancy that the jury has to resolve. Thanks a lot to the panel tonight. A reminder, folks, I'll be working on the website next week. I won't be here on the debrief. We will stay on the air, though, with many guest hosts. So I will see you in more than a week. Good night.